You are listening to an ADIS podcast.
Hi, everyone. I'm Peter Black. I'm a urologic oncologist at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. And welcome to this webinar on high-risk non-muscle invasive bladder cancer. Bernie, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Bernie Eigel. I'm a medical oncologist specializing in bladder cancer at the Vancouver Cancer Center in British Columbia, Canada.
So it's our pleasure to welcome you today to this podcast. I'd like to acknowledge that the podcast was supported by Pfizer, and we've had editorial support from Hanya Javid of Envision Pharma, and it was funded by Pfizer.
The goal of this podcast is to provide an overview of the non-muscle invasive bladder cancer landscape with a focus on high-risk NMIBC. And this includes understanding the diagnosis and current treatment approaches, a focus on the unmet medical needs in high-risk non-muscle invasive bladder cancer treatment, highlighting the potential challenges associated with the introduction of PD-L1 therapies in NMIBC, and then to provide insights into the patient journey within the institution and its translation into practical settings. Finally, we'll explore future outlooks and directions for PD-1 use in non-muscle invasive bladder cancer treatment. Peter, maybe I'll start off with a question to you. How is non-muscle invasive bladder cancer defined, and what are the underlying pathophysiological factors and oncogenic pathways involved in the development and progression of high-risk non-muscle invasive bladder cancer?
Yeah, lots to say on that question, Bernie. I think, you know, one thing I always like to highlight to patients is how common bladder cancer actually is, because many patients are surprised that they have it and never really heard of it. But it's the 11th most common cancer worldwide. And for us in Canada and also in the US, it's the 6th most common cancer. So it's a very common disease. We distinguish non-muscle invasive from muscle invasive bladder cancer. About 3/4 is non-muscle invasive, meaning it hasn't invaded into the trusor muscle of the bladder wall. And typically non-muscle invasive bladder cancer, we're trying to preserve the bladder, whereas muscle invasive is treated more aggressively with surgery and or radiation. Within non-muscle invasive, it's made up of 3 different stages, really. So there's carcinoma in situ, which are flat lesions just in the urothelial lining. There's no real tumor formation. There are the papillary TA tumors, which are non-invasive, but they form like polyps growing into the lumen of the bladder. And then the T1 tumors, which are sort of the transition towards muscle invasive, because they actually show invasion into the subepithelial layer below the mucosa. Within these, especially TA, so carcinoma in situ is always considered high grade. So it has aggressive cytologic features under the microscope. But the TA and T1 tumors can be further divided into high grade or low grade. And most TAs are low grade, most T1s are high grade. Sometimes we'll still see in the older classification system, the 1973 WHO classification system, which will classify as grade 1, grade 2, or grade 3. And of course, grade 2s are always the problematic ones because we don't know whether we call them high or low grade, which influences how we treat the tumors. So beyond the stage, you know, TA, T1, CIS, and the grade, we also have a risk stratification. So we put it all together and we include some other risk factors. For example, age has come up as a risk factor in the European classification. Age greater than 70 is an adverse factor. But we can, there are different risk stratification systems to classify patients as low risk, intermediate risk, or high risk. And we're talking about risk of recurrence, but especially risk of progression. So high-risk tumors have a high risk of progression to muscle-invasive bladder cancer and need to be treated aggressively. Low risk will almost never progress, and of course, intermediate risk is in between there. They all tend to recur, so recurrence is a little bit different. One of the main points of difference within the classification systems is what do we do with the high-grade TA tumors, which we've considered high risk in the past, and most clinical trials have considered them high risk, yet they're often now classified as intermediate risk. So it's up to the individual urologist a little bit to decide how they're going to deal with those patients. I think another risk feature that we have with non-muscle invasive bladder cancer are the histologic subtypes. Previously, we talked about variant histology, but some of the T1 tumors that are invasive into lamina propria, they can have different morphologies, for example, a micropapillary or a sarcomatoid carcinoma. And those really need to be treated more aggressively. They have a higher risk of being understaged. So they're actually muscle invasive and we think they're not. They may have nodal involvement and typically they need to be treated with cystectomy. There are molecular correlates to all of this. And, you know, we'd spend another half hour talking about those issues, but we think of non-muscle invasive bladder cancer as evolving along two molecular pathways, which explains a little bit of the differences in risk of progression. So the low grade tumors, and you know, all low risk tumors are low grade, and almost all intermediate risk tumors are low grade. They are very frequently mutated in FGFR3, so fibroblast growth factor receptor 3, or in HRAS. And these are sort of proliferative genes that just they drive growth, meaning proliferation, but they don't necessarily lead to invasion. So they're still at risk for recurrence and that type of thing, but they don't invade. Whereas the second pathway, which are most high-grade tumors in CIS, they have mutations in P53 and retinoblastoma gene, which I think we've all heard of. And those alterations lead to a more invasive phenotype that's at risk for progression. And I would say lastly, just with respect to molecular classification, is that we can classify based on RNA expression, which has become popular in muscle-invasive bladder cancer, but can also be carried over to non-muscle-invasive. And most non-muscle-invasive, if we're thinking of the big luminal versus basal split, almost all non-muscle-invasive are luminal. And then there are newer classification systems that will subdivide that further. Those haven't really gotten into clinical practice yet. Those are still experimental tools.
So many nuances in the diagnosis and approach to this disease. Let me ask you about what does it look like from the patient's point of view? What are the diagnosis and treatment approaches for patients with high-risk non-muscle invasive bladder cancer?
Yeah, I think, you know, as a urologist in practice, we have a couple of tools that we use most frequently for diagnosis. Cystoscopy certainly is the cornerstone. We want to visually see and identify tumors and characterize them. We can use urine markers as an adjunct, and I think cytology is used quite widely because it can reveal things that we might not see. So you may have high-grade cancer cells in the urine that you haven't seen a tumor, and it's very high specificity. So if cytology is positive, there's probably something there. There are various other urine markers that are in development. There's many that have been abandoned, but there are newer, very interesting ones that are coming on the market as well. So we have to see how we implement those. But typically a patient will have a cystoscopy to diagnose the tumor, and then they'll have an endoscopic resection, so a transurethral resection of bladder tumor, TURBT. And that's where we really confirm the diagnosis by getting tissue to send to the lab. And the pathologist will tell us the stage, the grade, are there any histologic subtypes, all that type of thing. We can use the past history of tumors, patient age, as I mentioned, those types of things to then risk stratify. And based on the risk stratification and patient factors, we decide how to treat. We will use imaging often for high-risk non-muscle invasive bladder cancer. We'll typically image the upper tract, so kidneys and ureters, most often with a CT-IVP, but MRI can also be used. It can be important, of course, also to look at local staging in the bladder, but it's primarily for the upper tracts. When it comes to treating, there are some guidelines. You know, we have Canadian guidelines, there are EAU and AUA guidelines, of course, to guide treatment. But the treatment of high-risk disease is actually fairly uniform around the world. That after TUR, if there's T1 disease, patients typically get a second TUR to make sure that we haven't understaged them. And so that's very important. It's kind of a peculiarity of non-muscle invasive bladder cancer that we go back and do the same thing again. We may do a radical cystectomy for the highest risk patients. I mentioned, for example, micropapillary and sarcomatoid tumors, T1 tumors. So that is always on the table. But the standard of care for most patients with high-risk disease will be intravesical BCG therapy. So it's a type of immunotherapy. BCG is the vaccine used for tuberculosis, and it's multiple instillations into the bladder over time, both induction and maintenance. ECG is relatively effective, but when it doesn't work, and it certainly, you know, there are patients who don't respond or they recur afterwards, we don't really have good second line options, or we haven't had good second line options until recently. We have two recent additions, FDA approved additions in the US and developing elsewhere. One is pembrolizumab, so a PD-1 inhibitor given systemically, so intravenously, which is a paradigm shift for non-muscle invasive bladder cancer, but that can be effective in patients who have BCG unresponsive high risk disease. And most recently, nadofaragene firadenovec is a gene therapy that leads to interferon production in the tumors. That's also been approved, and that's an intravesical therapy, approved but not yet launched, so we don't have experience with that yet. In the absence of those two recently approved drugs, a lot of patients will get the combination chemo, gemcitabine, and docetaxel as a second-line treatment after BCG. But that's only based on retrospective data, so there's a bit of a data hole there. And of course, clinical trials are important for these patients. And so when possible, we try to get them on clinical trials.
Well, that leads to the next natural question, which is, what are the unmet medical needs in high-risk non-muscle invasive bladder cancer treatment?
Yeah, I think, BCG we've actually this year celebrated 50 years of BCG therapy, which is quite remarkable for something so simple. But it also, it tells you on the one hand that it works well, and maybe it tells you that we haven't made rapid progress in the management of bladder cancer. But the big issues are, the big, gaps are that some patients will not respond to BCG, so maybe up to a third. Those that do respond are still at risk of recurrence, so greater than a half. And overall, there's a significant risk of progression, especially patients with T1 and carcinoma in situ. And that can be in the order of 15 to 20% after a few years. And progression is what we really worry about. We know that if patients progress to muscle invasive disease from non-muscle invasive disease, that they have a much worse outcome, actually a worse outcome than if they were diagnosed with muscle invasive disease in the first place. So recurrence, progression is a problem. BCG shortage has been a huge problem around the world for the last 10 years. We've been lucky in Canada, it hasn't been as impactful, but it's still leading to treatment shortcomings in the US, for example. And so if you don't even have BCG, there are no good alternatives really for the first line treatment of high risk non-muscle invasive disease. Some people are moving to chemotherapy, which we think is not as good. If we have BCG, there's still an issue of tolerance. So patients will often discontinue because of side effects. Compliance is a problem. Some patients are ineligible. So for example, we see patients who've had kidney transplants and they're on immunosuppression. And so we think there's a higher risk of complications with BCG, and we don't know if it's going to work with immunosuppression. So those patients don't have any good options currently. So yeah, there are a lot of potential limitations, and we really need new treatments for, as alternative to BCG in those who can't get it, or if there's no BCG available, and then certainly for second line. In the second line, so if a patient's BCG unresponsive, we will often recommend a cystectomy, which is, of course, a huge surgery. Many patients are not fit for it. Many patients will decline it. And there's no question, those who have it, that it impacts quality of life. So more effective bladder-preserving therapies would allow us to avoid that life-altering surgery. So Bernie, maybe I can ask you the next question, which is, how does BCG work? What do we know about its mechanism of action? And how might a PD-1 or PD-L1 inhibitor work in addition, or maybe even synergistically with BCG, that we could justify combining the two?
Yeah, so I work with immunotherapies all the time, but it truly, BCG is probably the archetypal immunotherapy. After intravesical instillation, it infects the bladder urothelial cells and induces a local immune activation. It works through different elements of both the innate and adaptive immune system to hopefully eradicate the bladder cancer and prevent recurrence. For example, BCG treatment decreases myeloid-derived suppressor cells and increases activation and infiltration of T cells into tumor tissue via cytokine production. In both preclinical and clinical settings, it's been reported that BCG may upregulate PD-L1 expression, which is interesting given the agents we have available now. PD-L1 inhibitors, in contrast, disinhibit the immune system. So they really will unmask cancers, hopefully, that are using the PD-1 signaling axis to evade the immune system through sending out self-signals. And one can then hypothesize that maybe the combination of BCG and PD-L1 inhibitors can inhibit tumor growth even further. And we see this in other areas now where we're using immunotherapies in the advanced bladder cancer setting with antibody-drug conjugates in combination or sequencing with chemotherapy, that there is likely a synergism in terms of the immune system being activated and more antigen presented through the other therapy prior to or along with PD-1 therapies. PD-1 targeted therapies have proven activity in more advanced forms of esophageal cancer, as I've said. Pembrolizumab, nivolumab, atezolizumab, durvalumab, and nivolumab are all PD-1 or PD-L1 inhibitors that have been approved by the FDA for refractory metastatic urothelial cancer. The rationale of using PD-1 inhibitors along BCG specifically to optimize patient outcomes in BCG-naive, high-risk, non-muscle invasive cancer can be summarized as there being really a significant unmet need for improved treatments of high-risk non-muscle invasive bladder cancer because of all the reasons you've already alluded to, Peter. There is a robust preclinical rationale, as I've stated. And PD-1 inhibitor as monotherapy has been demonstrated to have efficacy in BCG-unresponsive high-risk non-muscle invasive bladder cancer.
So, Bernie, what are the potential challenges that we might encounter if we introduce PD-1, PD-L1 inhibition into treatment of high-risk non-muscle invasive bladder cancer, especially if it moves into the first line?
Yeah, I think there's quite a few challenges and opportunities as well. Guys like you and me are going to be working more closely together, I think, as time goes on. But really, that's part of it, the identification and referral of patients most likely to benefit from these therapies. We don't know exactly who the right patient at the right time is yet. Currently, pembrolizumab is FDA approved for BCG unresponsive high risk non-muscle invasive bladder cancer, but it's rarely used. It demonstrated modest efficacy compared with previous studies with intravesical chemotherapies, but it carries a higher risk of systemic toxicity than intravesical therapy. And those need to be managed in a multidisciplinary setting, especially the immune related adverse events. And of course, it's much, much more costly. So really improving multidisciplinary care collaboration, cooperation, and having the right people managing the different therapies is going to be important to improve shared decision-making. And really, when we look at it now, the management of patients with high-risk NMIBC has been almost exclusively in the hands of urologists who really are doing all the work that's involved in diagnosing and managing this disease. But the introduction of PD-1 inhibitors is going to represent a systemic treatment that up to this point really has been in the realm of the medical oncologists and for good reason. Monitoring and managing the immune-related adverse events of these agents requires close follow-up and really teamwork with other medical specialties in managing the specific types of adverse events they are, whether they're respiratory, GI, rheumatologic, and so forth. And financial constraints, especially in Canada, are going to create potential barriers to patient access. And of course, patient and physician education is going to be very important.
Yeah, I think it's funny if you think of other disease states where we share patients between medical oncology and urology, there's really significant overlap, but here there's almost no overlap currently. I mean, medical oncologists generally don't see non-muscle invasive bladder cancer. There are some places where the medical oncologists are doing intravesical therapy, and urologists simply do not do immune checkpoint therapy. And now we're going to have to really merge and do it together. I see one of the biggest challenges being just getting the urologists to refer the patients, recognizing that this is a new treatment, that it has, if it's shown to be efficacious, that it is efficacious, and patients need to see a medical oncologist, because that's not the norm to now, up to now, and these paradigm shifts are often challenging.
Yeah, and I think it really is very much a team approach, not just for medical oncology and urology, but like I said, the other specialties, because if immune-related adverse events are picked up early and managed early, then patients can still benefit from further treatment. But if things are not, then, you know, in a best case scenario, the adverse event is dealt with, but patients wouldn't be eligible for further therapy.
And I think the experience with pembrolizumab in the BCG unresponsive setting hasn't really tested the waters, because it's really only used in the US. And even there, the efficacy has been marginal, so that there hasn't been a lot of buy-in. So, you know, if we had immune checkpoint blockade in the first line for high-risk disease, it would be a much bigger indication. And if the evidence is compelling, it really does represent a new challenge.
So, Peter, at your institution, what does the patient journey look like? Patients who present, what different roles do healthcare professionals play? And walk me through the journey.
Yeah, so patients will usually start with their family doctor. They'll almost all bladder cancer patients present with gross hematuria, sometimes microhematuria. A smaller percentage will have voiding symptoms, frequency, urgency, that type of thing. But they will end up in primary care. The primary care will refer to the urologist, recognizing the need to screen for bladder cancer. We will typically, after doing the usual history and physical and that type of thing, will move straight to cystoscopy. And if we see a tumor, we will take the patient to the operating room for a complete resection, so a TURBT. And then, of course, we'll get the report back from the pathologist that tells us what the tumor is, and we can then risk stratify. And that's when we then sit down with the patient and say, okay, this is what you have, and this is what we would recommend. And together with the patient, we work out a treatment plan, whether that be another TURBT or BCG or even cystectomy. You'll note, of course, that the medical oncologist doesn't really have a role in any of this up to this point, except in some centers where the medical oncologist does administer the intravesical therapy. I'd say that nurses are perhaps the other important team member, as they will often be administering the intravesical therapy. And they, in that context, have a very important counseling role as well. They see the patients a lot and help them through all the side effects of treatment. During treatment, after treatment, patients will continue to see the urologist frequently for cystoscopy, and will often do urine cytology at the same time. Typically, that's every 3 months for 2 years, then every 6 months for 2 years. So it's quite intensive. And together with the nursing staff, we'll manage any side effects. If there's recurrence or progression, of course, we jump in again and manage those. So Bernie, if we embark on a new era of immune checkpoint blockade for high-risk non-muscle invasive bladder cancer, what do you think are going to be the keys to make this work effectively, and also the potential pitfalls that we want to avoid as we roll this out?
Yeah, so I think just as muscle invasive bladder cancer is very much a team-based approach where we have to work very closely together, medical oncology and urology and other specialties. The same is true if and when PD-L1 inhibitors move into the earlier disease setting. And so the teamwork is important, but the teams also have to be well-trained to do what they do. And so clear treatment guidelines and protocols need to be developed and further refined. Treatment approaches need to be standardized, really to help healthcare professionals across jurisdictions make informed and consistent decisions for patients. Collaborative care needs to be provided, like I said, along with access to the appropriate healthcare specialists. And that's not just, again, urologists and medical oncologists, but really there needs to be a network in place for the, you know, relatively uncommon adverse events that happen with immunotherapies, but the ones that really need specialist intervention early. Insufficient and communication and coordination or lack of proper care can lead to fragmented care with really not the best outcomes. Patients also need to be educated about immunotherapy, and I spend a lot of time doing this. So they need to be aware of not just the potential benefits, but also the risks and the toxicities that are involved, and making sure that they respond early with reports of any toxicities so that we can investigate and treat appropriately. I think equally, it's important that medical oncologists are more educated on non-muscle invasive bladder cancer. It's an area that really we've had the benefit of ignoring for a very long time, and now we really are becoming practitioners in that area, and so need to be well-trained on diagnosis management of this disease. Access to PD-1 inhibitors and concerns regarding the affordability of this also will need to be addressed. Limited access due to reimbursement challenges or high costs, for example, can negatively impact patients' outcomes once these are standard treatments.
I think from a urologic perspective, if this were used much more commonly and urologists were thinking of prescribing these agents, I think the big thing that we're lacking, certainly we were able to learn, but you need the support system. You need to be able to, you know, to have your team that can deal with side effects rapidly. You also need the support to educate the patient and those types of things. I think that might be what many don't see initially, and I think that's a particularly important piece of the puzzle. I must say, I also look forward to you calling me up and say, "Hey, I think it's time for you to do another cystoscopy on this patient." So,
let me ask you a two-part question here. How is the landscape of NMIBC expected to change with more widespread use of these checkpoint inhibitors? And how will it impact healthcare professionals and patients?
Yeah, it's interesting to think how bringing this treatment into the first line could impact things. You know, for non-muscle invasive bladder cancer, it's actually considered an advantage that you can put drugs into the bladder and avoid systemic therapy. So we think that's a good thing. But of course, there's a lot of bladder toxicity, and a lot of catheters are being placed for BCG once a week for 6 weeks, and then, you know, total of 27 times over 3 years. That's pretty invasive. And so the idea of being able to give a systemic therapy, whether it's intravenous, oral, subcutaneous, may be attractive to a lot of patients, as long as the toxicity is, the systemic toxicity is justifiable. So that's one thing. There are certainly a lot of patients, especially when you get into second, third line treatments, who have problems holding the drugs in their bladder for the necessary period of time. So that might actually be a beneficial thing. On the other hand, if we're going to be doing this early on, we do need to be aware of the immune-related and other adverse events, and systemic therapy for non-muscle invasive diseases would be a paradigm shift. It's not something we're used to. And so we would need to get everybody on board, as you've already alluded to, Bernie, to make sure that we deal with those potential complications promptly and effectively. The other element is just, you know, as the landscape potentially shifts, is that we will need more education and training, as you've also alluded to. So around, you know, the mechanisms of actions of the drugs, when should they be used, what patients need to be referred, how was the dosing and the schedule going to be, you know, what are the risks, et cetera. So that'll also have a real impact on how we're practicing medicine for these patients with non-muscle invasive bladder cancer. So Bernie, as we think of some of these issues that we need to address as we introduce checkpoint blockade for high-risk non-muscle invasive bladder cancer, how can the urologists and the medical oncologists cooperate to help improve patient outcomes?
Yeah, I mean, cooperation is key in this, and for patient safety and for best outcomes. And I'm very lucky in the setting that we're in, you know, in an academic setting where we're across the street from each other, and you don't know if you're happy or not to know that you're on my speed dial. But it really is, you know, the relationship between the urologist and the GU medical oncologist has to be a very close one when you're managing patients with bladder cancer in settings where the physical proximity is not necessarily so close. And then, you know, in the real world, I think this has to be something that is done with thought and actually active intention. So establishing regular communication channels, joint meetings, multidisciplinary tumor boards, case discussions, these are all actions that allow for improved coordination and encourages shared decision-making, but also the sharing of what happens with these patients so that you can learn from each event as you go, promoting interdisciplinary education and training programs to facilitate knowledge exchange between specialists, of course, and again, involving, we have rounds at least a couple of times a year where specialists who deal with the immune-related adverse events are invited. So rheumatologists come, or endocrinologists, or respirologists, and we learn not only how these events are managed, but again, how to look for warning signs before they become serious events. We need to work through jurisdictions to develop standardized care pathways and treatment protocols once these agents are out in the real world. That involved the joint input of urologists, oncologists, and other specialists. And then really, fostering a culture of collaboration and implementing a team and patient-oriented approach. And again, this involves nursing and other allied health professionals specifically for NMIBC treatment. Some urologists, I'll say uro-oncologists, may consider administering PD-1 inhibitor therapies independent of medical oncologists. I think the world may well evolve that way in due course. If PD-1 inhibitors are used more widely in the treatment of this disease, it may provide the necessary patient volume to gain experience for their independent use. But this will take time and education. And again, specialized knowledge and training on patient selection, contraindications, identification and management of potential side effects. And so systems would have to be developed to truly allow this, and I would say in centers of expertise. But as I said, in most centers, the real appropriate approach would be multidisciplinary care with medical oncologists and urologists both involved.
Yeah, I think even if, for urologists to adopt this, I think it could only come out of a close cooperation with medical oncologists, learning from medical oncologists. I think, you often hear about, with the early introduction of immunotherapy, there were severe adverse events and even deaths that are attributed to inexperience, and things have gotten better as we've gotten better at recognizing the early signs. And really, the last thing we want to do is to relearn all those lessons at the expense of patient well-being. So I think that is just super critical, that if new physicians are doing it, that they do it really in close collaboration. But ultimately, I think you're right. I think patients will be co-managed between us. One thing, Bernie, I was thinking about for education, is it just you talking to the patient during a consultation? Or is there a more formal education program? Are there, nurses that sit down, or how does that work?
Yeah, for sure. So in the advanced setting, when we use immunotherapies, absolutely the first line of education would come from me when I'm doing my initial consultation, but a nurse would have an education session with a patient as well prior to initiation of therapy. And then at the time of infusion, again, there's teaching, and they're teaching opportunities for nurses to provide while the drug is being infused. We have a program in place where we have nurse callouts during the first cycle to make sure that there are no emerging toxicities early, and patient education and patient education materials that they can have with them to identify that they're on immunotherapy are also part of it. So it really is a multi-pronged, multidisciplinary approach to make sure that problems are identified early. And, with the newer checkpoints, with the PD-1 specific checkpoints, as opposed to the first iteration of immunotherapies, you're right, the toxicities are less, they're less frequent. But again, they can be picked up early before they become a big problem. And that's key.
And these patients have potentially curable disease by other means. So I think there's going to be less tolerance for severe toxicity. Good. Well, Bernie, I think that we can wrap up this discussion. I think we've talked about how there really is a compelling rationale to test PD-L1 or PD-1 therapy in non-muscle invasive bladder cancer. And, we haven't talked about the trials, but the trials have been completed and we're waiting for them to report out. And, if positive, this will really cause a major shift in the landscape of non-muscle invasive bladder cancer treatment and all the different things that go along with that.
Yeah, Peter, I've really enjoyed this conversation, and I agree. We're in the midst of very exciting times, and again, probably a paradigm shift in the management of this disease. And I think that the important take-home message is that with these agents, multidisciplinary care and collaboration is going to be key in providing the best care for our patients. So I look forward to working even more closely with you.
As do I, and I would thank everybody for tuning in and listening.
You are listening to an ADIS podcast. You can listen to more podcasts by subscribing to ADIS podcast with your preferred podcast provider or by visiting the journal website. For a full list of declarations, including funding and author disclosure statements, please read the article on the journal website.